again, everyone, and welcome to it, the Daily Daily Color Podcast for the fourth day of July 2019, the day after. Not talking about the post-apocalyptic nuclear war made-for-TV movie from the 80s. That was tame compared to what we had happen yesterday in Washington, D.C. I am Derek Hunter. I am your host. You can email the show, Derek, D-E-R-E-K, at dailycaller.com with compliments, complaints, and whatever else you got, questions, and sometimes I'll answer them on the show. So send them in. Give me what you got. Thank you for listening. Thank you for telling a friend. We are growing at an alarming rate on this program, and that is all thanks to you. You're the only advertising we got. You and my cats don't even have Twitter accounts, so I appreciate you spreading the word and doing me that solid, and I appreciate the kind words that you guys send, and the compliments, and the complaints. I like the complaints, too. I respond to all of them through email, so send them along. Oh, man, there's so much going on. We've got the second half of the show is the Friday video edition, where I sat down with my friend Brian Darling, who actually wrote a handbook used by United States senators to understand the rules of the Senate. He's worked a long time on Capitol Hill. He doesn't right now, but he doesn't anymore. He went into business for himself. But he explains exactly what to expect in the coming Congress as Democrats took over the House of Representatives yesterday and the Republican majority in the Senate expanded by two. It's going to be an interesting time. And there's some interesting rules and certain things that still can be done, even with Democrats controlling the House. So you're going to want to stick around for that. The music will reset the show then. But I want to get to a few things before we get to that. A few things that happened yesterday. That strange disturbance in the force that you felt in the early afternoon was the reascension of Nancy Pelosi to the Speaker of the House role. It is not the first time that somebody has regained the speakership. Sam Rayburn did it. But he was a guy, and Nancy Pelosi identifies as a woman. Therefore, it is treated as though it's Neil Armstrong all over again. So the media was all about, oh, it's so historic. Nancy Pelosi, look, I don't know how Nancy Pelosi identifies. I assume it's not as a guy. I assume it's as a woman. But the media was all like, oh, it's so historic. Nancy Pelosi is regaining, and it's been done. Can we get over the fact that people do things, and then other people do those things, and then someone from every flavor of human being has to do something, and we have to celebrate it like everybody's Neil Armstrong? There's one Neil Armstrong. There's one Buzz Aldrin. In the sense of a Speaker of the House regaining the speakership, Nancy Pelosi is not Neil Armstrong just because she happens to use the ladies' room. She is more Buzz Aldrin. Still pretty impressive to be Buzz Aldrin. He's the second man on the earth. He's still alive. I'm never going to be Speaker of the House. The odds are pretty much against you ever being Speaker of the House. So the fact that Nancy Pelosi is Speaker of the House is accomplishment enough. It shouldn't require the caveat of, she's the first woman ever to be Speaker of the House, and the first woman to regain being Speaker of the House. I know Democrats live for this crap, but it drives me nuts that they just look at somebody's accomplishment and they can't look at it as an accomplishment for an individual, as an individual. It has to be, look at their skin tone. Look at their this. Look at their sexuality. Look at all of these irrelevant facts to how they conduct themselves in their jobs. Honestly, I really kind of wish three of every type of configuration of human being would do everything. Just get it done. Because after three, we kind of stopped, not we, but the media, the left, kind of stopped paying attention and treating it like it is some sort of serious accomplishment. They just kind of blow it off. I wish we would get to that point, except getting to that point would probably be horrible because a lot of those people would be liberals. So Yes, the media was beside itself with joy over the history made by Nancy Pelosi. And when she regained the gavel, she stammered her way through her speech. It's a long tradition where the new Speaker of the House gives a rambling speech. They just fill it up with platitudes. It's a garbage speech. It doesn't mean anything. Talk of bipartisanship and for the good of the country. And then they set about warring against each other and lying about each other and trying to push their agenda no matter how unpopular it is. It's damn the torpedoes, full steam ahead. Don't let the facts stand in the way of a good story. And we aren't going to let the will of the American people stand in the way of our agenda. But it's funny because during Nancy Pelosi's closing of her speech, she already has a problem with speaking. She sounds as though perhaps, as one emailer wrote yesterday, like she doesn't properly secure her dentures to the roof of her mouth. That's entirely possible. But she sounds more like she's kind of chewing or choking. I think it's more of a nervous tic to try and buy some time till she thinks of the next word. But in her speech before the House of Representatives, she didn't really have that problem because it was written down. Turns out, though, that the smartest woman ever to walk upright since Hillary Clinton had a different problem with her own speech. Kind of a funny moment. It's a hot mic moment. At the end here, this clip you're about to hear is Nancy Pelosi wrapping up her platitude-filled, pointless speech. Then you're going to hear her say something. She's going to say, "I think I skipped a couple of pages. I'm not sure." You have to listen closely for it because she'd wrapped up her speech and the House is giving the applause that everybody gets. It's very polite applause. Yesterday was a show day where everybody gets along and they all talk about Hopi this and Changey that and how we're all going to kumbaya our way forward. And then, of course, it all falls apart immediately thereafter. But listen to Nancy Pelosi wrap up her garbage speech. And then realize, oh, I think I skipped a couple of pages. I guarantee you, there is not one single person in the audience going, "I wish this speech were just a little bit longer. If you could give me, 10 more minutes of Nancy Pelosi blowing smoke up my rear end, then that would be a complete inauguration day." Here's Nancy.
"Let us pray that God may bless our work and crown our good with brotherhood and sisterhood from sea to shining sea. God bless you all, and God bless the United States of America." Thank you. I think I skipped a couple of pages. I'm not sure.
"I think I skipped a couple of pages, but I'm not sure." Did you not pre-read the speech, Nancy? And how do you skip a couple of pages on a speech? Nancy is not necessarily with it, ladies and gentlemen, and I mean that in a good way. I could say a lot worse about her, but I'm not going to. We'll have plenty of time to say worse about her later. But right after the inauguration, and before the parties started, and there were a lot of parties in Washington, D.C. last night, even Republicans were having parties, celebrating the new Congress. Yay, yay, yay. You should be kind of humiliated and sort of hunkered down trying to come up with an agenda that will win back the voters you lost because you didn't pass the agenda last time you were elected to implement. But no, they were out drinking and meeting the press and schmoozing with God knows who, just like the Democrats were doing. But before they got to that, on the first day, as always happens, the bills start coming in, and the Democrats were no different. Democrats introduced two bills yesterday, actually two constitutional amendments. They'll go absolutely nowhere, but it lets you know the sense of who these people are deep down in their souls. Congressman Stephen Cohen, Democrat from Tennessee, introduced both constitutional amendments. He wants, one, to get rid of the Electoral College. The Democratic Party hate this country. They really are a party of contrasts. It's kind of bizarre. Get rid of the Electoral College. We need to be a direct democracy. This country would go to hell in a handbasket pretty quickly if we were, and if you didn't live in New York and California, you can pretty much forget about anybody caring about you. But I find it interesting that they want to get rid of the Electoral College because they hate the idea of federalism. They hate the idea that states have rights. They have the right to do their own thing if they so choose. This country was, a good way to put it, I forget who I first heard this from, but the country, the federal government was created by the states. The states were not created by the federal government. We are a system, a union of states, hence the name, the United States of America. And in that union, the states were supposed to be free to conduct their business however they see fit, with very few restrictions on how a state could conduct itself from the federal government. Very important restrictions, but very few restrictions. Democrats hate this concept. They want to be able to impose their will across the country on just about anything and everything. And in a large, to a large point, they actually do now, but they do it by ignoring the Constitution. They still hate the concept of states having rights. So it's bizarre to see them then on issues such as immigration start asserting the concept of states' rights, the antithesis of almost everything that the Democratic Party stands for nowadays. When California declares itself a sanctuary state and the Department of Justice moves to punish them, or a jurisdiction like San Francisco, for example, if they, when they declare themselves to be a sanctuary city and the Justice Department moves to punish them, just like the state, by denying them grants, you know, saying, hey, if you're going to break the law, if you're going to ignore federal law, we're not going to send you federal dollars for certain projects. And Democrats sue. It's an outrage. They are disgusted at the concept because that's federal law. It's not state law, immigration. They are free as states, as independent states, to pretty much conduct themselves any way they want without any regard to federal law when it comes to immigration, or so they say. Suddenly, they're making a states' rights argument. And in the case of cities, they're making an argument for local control. Again, the antithesis of what the Democratic Party in general claims, but their principles aren't really principles. Their goals are consistent. Their principles are malleable. Their principles can be changed on a whim or ignored or flipped 180 degrees if it suits the need of the agenda. So I find that to be ironic that now they're saying, well, we need to do away with the Electoral College, which is a constitutional recognition that states are separate entities, unique entities that are a part of the United States. They essentially want to do away with all borders and just go for a straight up popular vote. That would be an absolute and total disaster. Thankfully, that is unlikely to happen in our lifetime, at least through a constitutional amendment. Constitutional amendments are incredibly difficult to pass. They have to pass both houses of Congress. Then they have to be ratified by 3/4 of the states, which is highly unlikely in this day and age and in this political environment. But still, it lets you know where Democrats fall, what their intentions are. The second amendment that was proposed by Representative Cohen was to limit, curtail the pardon powers of the President of the United States. Democrats are so convinced that Donald Trump has a pile of dead bodies somewhere covered in ill-gotten rubles, and it's just waiting to be discovered by someone, and his whole family's in on it, and everybody in his administration is in on it, that they introduced a piece of legislation, a constitutional amendment, that would disallow the President of the United States unambiguously from pardoning himself, members of their family, and members of their administration or staff, or campaign staff. That is patently ridiculous. The Constitution says that the pardon power is pretty much absolute. You can't then say, but unless you happen to be related to the president, and that you have these carve-outs. Rights are either absolute or they are not absolute. Well, at least that's the way it should be, as we see with the First Amendment and freedom of speech. Freedom of speech is absolute if you aren't a conservative trying to speak on a college campus, if you aren't a conservative trying to speak pretty much anywhere. Then Democrats will condemn you. They will go after you. They will try to punish you if you say something offensive. No, if you're a comedian, they'll try and ruin your life. They won't try to throw you in prison. They haven't reached that point yet. But if people keep speaking in ways that Democrats don't like, you never know. But they want to eliminate the Electoral College, and they want to limit the president's pardoning power. These are constitutional amendments specific to Donald Trump. This is how sick these people are. This is how singularly focused these people are. Who is this going to help aside from Democrats? How is this going to make the economy better? What kind of jobs is this going to create? None of them. Of course, nothing. It won't happen, but they don't give a damn. This is all to placate their radical base. It's unlikely that either one of these will ever get a vote in the House of Representatives, just like the bills that are introduced by Democrats to propose reparations. They push this crap all the time. They want reparations. They just want a committee now to study reparations and study the implications of reparations. I tell you what, we'll cut a check. The country should cut a check to everybody who was a slave in this country. Absolutely. Come on forward, and we will write you a big fat check. Everybody else, forget about it. If you have a problem with the oppression that existed in this country lifetimes ago, talk to the party that did it. Talk to the party that started a civil war over their desire to keep doing it. Don't punish people who had nothing to do with it. We aren't freaking Klingons here. Although you wouldn't know that from the leftists. You're guilty of the sins of your father and for generations in your family. They are all guilty of the sins of somebody back long before you were born. That's not how we look. For a party that calls itself progressive and always, remember, in the Obama administration, they had the slogan, forward. Or was that, it was forward because then MSNBC said lean forward. So the Obama administration was saying forward, MSNBC was lean forward, and I think CNN was lean forward and bend your ankles, grab your ankles, something like that. I could be wrong. I might be misremembering my history, but I knew forward was in there sometime. For a party that claims to be very concerned about making progress and moving forward, they sure spend a lot of time obsessing about the past, obsessing about things that happened long ago. Everybody involved with which was dead, and everybody directly involved with them is dead. The children of the children are dead. But we must somehow be a horribly racist country simply because this horrible situation once existed in this country. It is nuts. They're crazy people. But what are you going to do? They're now in control of the House of Representatives, and they're going to push forward. They're going to push forward for Medicare for All, which is socialized medicine. They're going to push forward with their free college for everybody, meaning that you and I get to pay for it. So I get to write my monthly check to the student loans that I have to pay off, and I get to pay more in taxes so that somebody else doesn't have to suffer the fate of having to take care of themselves like I did. Bunch of crap. But this is what the people wanted. Think about this. How badly do Republicans have to run a campaign to lose to these people? That's how badly Republicans did in 2018, and we got 2 years to get our acts together and pull our heads out of our rear ends before it's too late, and then we're stuck with this for a very, very long time. Along those lines, I just want to move the show along quickly. I want to talk about this Pew poll that came out very briefly here, because this is the concept, or one of the concepts, that govern liberals' existence. They did a survey of the religious beliefs of the new Congress members, and they found, horror of all horrors, that Christians are overrepresented in Congress. And you think, what in the hell is overrepresented? Liberals believe that only white people can represent white people, only black people can represent black people, only Hispanic people can represent Hispanic people, and so on and so forth. And then you subdivide that down and all the groups that they love to divide people into, only gay people can represent gay people. And if you're a gay black person, then you got to be, and your eyes go cross-eyed by the time you get three or four steps down in this death spiral of stupidity. Well, Pew, being no different, because all liberals are liberals, they found that of the members of the Congress, there are 434 members of Congress, because the one seat down in South Carolina has yet to be decided, they found that 471 of those members were self-identified as Christians of some sort or another, and that makes them 88.2% of the Congress, yet gasp, of the U.S. population of adults in the U.S., only 71% agree or identify themselves as Christians. That means that there are significantly more, from a percentage standpoint, of Christians in Congress than there are Christians in this country. And I know you're sitting there and you're going, Derek, what the hell are you talking about? This is exactly the point. This is the kind of crap that liberals obsess about. You should have, because there's X number of people like this in the country, then we must have X number of people like that percentage-wise in the Congress of the United States. This is nuts. This is stupid. This is racist in many ways. Just because of the racial makeup or the ethnic makeup of members of Congress, it has nothing to do with the overall population. Members of Congress are elected by their congressional districts. So if Little Italy in New York decides, where there's a high concentration of Italians, decides, you know what, we're going to go with a guy from Australia. Originally from Australia, he's not Italian. Well, are suddenly the residents of Little Italy disenfranchised because they chose by majority vote to have somebody with Australian heritage represent them in Congress? No, that's their choice. So if a district is majority black and they happen to vote for a Hispanic member of Congress, is that somehow disenfranchising or punishing black people and underrepresenting black people in Congress? No, because it's an individual congressional district. What these numbers are when they go into the religious breakdowns or they go into the ethnic or racial breakdowns is they use nationwide numbers to talk about 435 individual House seats. It is apples to footballs. It is apples to foot massages. You can't compare these things, but it sounds bad if you are conditioned by the left to believe that we are a racist country, and B, there are put upon oppressed minorities who are simply being held down by the man and the existing power structure. It is crap, and the Pew Research Center should know better. They work with numbers for a living, but they know better. They just hope you don't know any better. I just thought I'd point that out. I also thought I'd point out a couple of more things. Nancy Pelosi yesterday in an interview on the Today Show got very angry with the President of the United States. Yeah, I don't think I'm going to play this audio just because we've heard enough of Nancy Pelosi. I can just tell you the gist of what she said. You can find it if you want. But she, as you know, was vacationing out in Hawaii at a very swanky resort, room starting at $900 a night all the way up to just south of $5,000 a night for the presidential suite. I don't know that Pelosi got the presidential suite, but I guarantee you she didn't stay in your average room, although our taxpaying dollars were used to put her security detail up there, most likely. In there, the interviewer, Savannah Guthrie, points out that President Trump had criticized Nancy Pelosi for going to Hawaii in the midst of a government shutdown rather than being in Washington and working like he was doing. Nancy Pelosi was outraged at this assertion, saying she can work pretty much from anywhere. And she gets really snotty and snarky and says that, well, I'll play one small clip from Nancy Pelosi where she says that Hawaii is a state. I don't know if Donald Trump knows this or not, but it is. Well, here's her saying that.
Is that a cheap shot?
But the fact, it's unimportant. It's totally unimportant. But the fact is, we all stood ready and we told our members we'll have 24 hours notice for all of us to be where we need to be. And the president may not know this, but Hawaii is part of the United States of America. Maybe he doesn't realize that.
Maybe he doesn't. We can go and we have telephones and internet out in Hawaii. We didn't need to be in Washington, D.C. We weren't going to cut a deal with him anyway, so screw it. Why should I stick around? The rooms were non-refundable, so I wasn't going to lose my money. Waste taxpayer money, sure, but not my money. This would be very interesting because if you remember at all during the Bush administration, the W. Bush administration, or just even the current Trump administration, when Donald Trump goes to Mar-a-Lago in Florida, which Nancy is also a part of the United States, has telephone lines, has internet, and when George W. Bush would go down to Texas to his ranch down there, Democrats and the media criticize them. It's day number 42 of his administration so far that President Bush has spent down in Texas. Back down there again. Blah, blah, blah. Donald Trump, why, he's down in Mar-a-Lago yet again. This is the fifth trip he's taken in the last 6 weeks. It's all garbage. They're acting as though when it was a Republican they were attacking and trying to smear. Why, it's unseemly that they would leave Washington, D.C. when there is so much work to be done. Well, I guarantee you that there is a significantly larger contingent of staff that travels with a president, any president of the United States, than even Speaker of the House, even though Nancy Pelosi wasn't Speaker of the House when she was out vacationing in Hawaii, living the dream while the government was shut down and the people she claims to be very concerned about were going without a paycheck. But it'd be very interesting because Democrats still attack Donald Trump. Well, he's going down to Florida again. He's going down to Mar-a-Lago again. This is ridiculous. He's living the dream while there's work to be done. Nancy Pelosi, hey, you've been out at a luxury resort in Hawaii while the government was shut down, meaning you are not actually actively in communication with the White House and your colleagues in the House or the Senate to try and remedy this situation. She says, well, I was in the United States and that's good enough. And Savannah Guthrie goes, why, you're sure? You're absolutely, I hadn't thought of it in those terms. Let's never speak of this again. Until, of course, a Republican does something remotely similar, and then it's an outrage and a sign of just how lazy and out of touch they are. God, it is good to be a Democrat for them. It'd be horrible to be a Democrat. I mean, trying to have to remember all these inconsistencies. But you're never held up for them. You're never held to account for them anyway. I want to play one bit of audio, speaking of double standards, before I get to an email and then we get to the interview. It is a clip. There is a warning here, a language warning. When I tell you, be warned, there's going to be an F-bomb, an MF-er. It's a new member of Congress, Rashida Tlaib, Democrat from my home state of Michigan, and real just gutter snipe pile of trash, anti-Semite woman. Progressive. She went to the MoveOn.org reception. Remember them? The ultra-fascist organization. You know, it's just socially acceptable to be a fascist if you're a liberal Democrat. They had a reception up on Capitol Hill, as a lot of organizations did, for new members of Congress. And Congress critter Tlaib said that basically, she's whining about her son and, oh, the bullies are going to win. And by the way, she's come to Washington, D.C. to impeach that MF-er. Language warning. I just want you to know who these people are that Democrats elected. So here you go.
People love you and you win. Woo! And when your son looks at you and says, Mama, look, you won.
bullies don't win. And I said, baby, they don't. Because we're going to go in there, we're going to impeach the motherfucker.
Isn't she nice? Isn't that lovely? And the crowd of barking seals clapping on command right there in the crowd. This is the Democratic base. This is who they are. This is what they want. We're going to go in there. We're going to impeach the MF-er. You remember when Mitch McConnell said on, I think it was election night 2010, often referred to by the left-wing media as election night 2008, which was not the case, when Mitch McConnell said that his goal was to make sure that Barack Obama was a one-term president, and how outraged liberals were, well, he's not going to work with Barack Obama at all. He's just there. They're the party of no. He's there to try and stop God from implementing God's will, and of course, God being Barack Obama. And they were mad about that, and they're still mad about that. Well, what do you say to somebody from your own party who is saying, you know what, we're going to go there and impeach Donald Trump? There is no crime. There is no high crime or misdemeanor. There is no treason, bribery, or high crime or misdemeanor. The grounds for impeachment under the Constitution. But Democrats don't give a damn about that. They want him gone. They hate him. They would prefer an assassin take him out, if you really get down to it. That seems to be, with their rhetoric and all the Hitler comparisons, what they want to happen. Because if you truly, honestly believe that Adolf Hitler reincarnate is living in residence at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and we're just this side of a Holocaust and a totalitarian dictatorship in the United States, you almost have a moral obligation to do something, don't you? That's what occurs to people who are mentally unstable. And Lord knows, on the left, they got mentally unstable in spades. And so to have rhetoric like this, not condemned by the mainstream media, she'll likely be on the Sunday shows. She'll likely be on MSNBC and CNN tomorrow being questioned about this. And she'll probably say something about, oh, maybe I shouldn't have used that kind of language, but it was a party and it just got out of hand. What she won't do is go any place where she would get a serious question, a significant question, be pressed on anything. She won't go on, well, I can't say all of it, but she won't go on Tucker Carlson Tonight, where he would actually ask her serious questions. She will hide. She will cry an anti-Muslim sentiment to anybody who criticizes her. She can go straight to hell. She can kiss my ass. And I mean that, and with all due respect, Congresswoman, that you're gutter trash. So, yeah, welcome to D.C. You no longer get to hide behind this crap. You are responsible for your words and your actions. And this, as a member of Congress, was one of your first sets of words and your first choice of actions. And it says more about you, quite frankly, than anybody you could ever criticize. I want to end this half of the program before we get to the interview. And it's a fascinating interview, so stick around for it. I want to read an email that sort of piqued my curiosity. It's from somebody named Brandy, and she has, it's a kind of a lengthy email. I'll read it quickly. So it says, quote, I keep asking myself every day, why do Democrats and Republicans have a hard time agreeing on anything? My best friend is a Democrat, voted for Hillary. We've been best friends for 20 years. She's a conservative. She voted for Trump. She wanted to vote for Cruz. On and on and on. Gets to the point they can't discuss politics. They're very opposite. They're both from Chicago. One's a White Sox fan. One's a Cubs fan. I kind of get the Cubs fan. I'm not a fan of either, but I just like the history of it. And then she writes that I recently commented on Twitter that I actually do believe that so many Democrats actually do want border security, but they're afraid to actually open their mouth because I think they're actually praying inside that we get it done. But they're afraid to say something and actually hope that we get it done without taking the hit. They want us to do the dirty work because they know the second they work with Donald Trump or Republicans, their scalp gets a giant price tag on it. and they will be punished by leadership for not hanging together. That's entirely possible. So she wants to perform a test, sort of a two-way test with her friend. She says, I'm going to be asking my best friend 10 or 20 questions that I'm going to ask that she can only answer yes or no to. But the yes or no response is what I want because I'm so tired of Fox and everywhere else when they answer a question and then they say but because they agree, but they want to disagree with some point. That really is all cable news is, a whole bunch of people. It's a conversation that you'd move away from if it were happening next to you in a restaurant. She says, quote, in turn, I'm going to ask my liberal best friend to ask me 10 to 20 questions that I can only answer yes or no to. She wants to know if I'm in and would I like to know what happens about it. And I'm kind of curious to know. I'd have to know the questions. I don't know that I'll read about it, but I just want to finish this and then tell you why I'm bringing this up on the show. She says she listens every morning, can't wait for my response. If you think it's trite, I won't do it. But I really do think it would be revealing and show that the left isn't as far from us as we think. I'd appreciate your thoughts before I put my questions together. Well, first of all, I want to thank you for the email, Brandy. And as far as whether or not the left is as far from us as we think or very similar, really does depend entirely on the issue. I will say this, that I'm in a situation similar to yours in that my best friend from high school through now is just a lefty, just a nut. The guy's a lunatic. I love him to death, but he's a freaking nutball. He and I do not talk politics anymore. We used to argue politics almost nonstop when it was new and for like the first 10 years of our friendship, like, let's just go at it. Let's go at it. Enough of that already. I can just say that that does wear thin after a while. And in the grand scheme of things, in your interpersonal relationships with your friends, with your family, it's good. You should be able to have a conversation with anybody you want to have a conversation with on any topic you both would like to have a conversation on. But it is not that important in the grand scheme of things on an individual basis. What matters is the direction of the country. If you get along with this person, and presumably since they're your best friend, I would assume that you get along with them. I would focus on those things. With my best friend, we just don't talk politics anymore. When we do, it's very quick and it's brought up organically, and one of us will either change the subject or just stop the conversation because we're not going to agree, and we accept that we're not going to agree. He lives in New Jersey now. We both grew up in Detroit. He's a doctor in New Jersey, and I'm me here in Maryland. We can't cancel each other's votes out anymore like we did when we were back in Michigan. And it's really, he's not going to change me. I'm not going to change him. That is just not the way it works anymore. Might score a point, but it would take so long that it would be really unworth the fight. So if you want to have this exercise, Brandy, if you want to have this fun, it can be fun. And anybody, I encourage anybody to have a conversation, whatever they want to have. But if you love the person, if you like the person, if you're friends with the person, it shouldn't matter what they think on politics. If there is anything politically, whether they're close to you or not close to you, it could be interesting from a sociological standpoint, I suppose, just to satisfy some curiosity. But in the grand scheme of things, if there is an issue on which your friendship could be destroyed, if somebody disagrees with you, you shouldn't be friends with that person in the first place if they disagree with you. People are always going to be disagreeing with you. There's not even a politician ever that has existed who has agreed with me 100% or I have agreed with them 100% because they're not me. You just accept that and move on. I get that it's a pain. I get that it's annoying. And you have these petty arguments on social media. And there are certain things you want to talk to your friend about. But It could lead to a big emotional discussion. It's just not worth it if that's where it is. If you can keep it tamped down, if you can keep it emotionally detached, then have the conversation. It could be neat to ask your questions, but the questions are going to be just as revealing about you as they will be about the yes or no answer you get about that. And at this point, after 20 years of friendship, you should be able to know where you agree or disagree, and you should be able to have that conversation in a civil way. And if you can't, after that long of a friendship, it really doesn't matter. It's just something that bubbled up at this particular moment. So if you go through with this, yes, please send me an email. I'd be curious to know how it went, whether or not you were able to remain civil and just stick to yes or no questions, both of you. But it's a rabbit hole that you're just going to, I don't see where it ends. I don't see what the point of it is. So that would be my advice, Brandy. Just if it's that important to you, I'd be more curious to know why it's that important to you and dig a little deeper into that. Because you could probably, frankly, answer the question for your friend just as well as they would, and pretty much the same way. A more interesting experiment would be write up the questions. You answer them the way you think they're going to answer them. You write that down and then see how well you know your friend. But that's up to you. It's your life. Do what you want to do. But there's my 2 cents or 2.5 cents or whatever. Now we go to the interview with Brian Darling, talk about the Congress this year, what we can expect from that, what Republicans can do in the Senate to get things done, what Republicans should have done at the end of last year to get things done, whether or not Republican leadership in the Senate in particular really does support a wall, and what President Trump can do on his own should he become like Barack Obama and rule by the stroke of a magic pen. We talk about all. It's a very interesting conversation, if I do say so myself. So here it is. All righty. Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the Daily Caller Podcast, the Friday video edition. If you're listening to the audio version of this program, this is the second start of the show. It's about the halfway point. I'm still Derek Hunter. I am your host. Every day we do an hour. By we, I mean me. And on Fridays, we do a chat with somebody who's either in the news or knows about the news. We're not like cable TV where we just grab some random douchebag off the street and say, now for a reaction we turn to. We talk to the people who are there doing it or have done it. And in this case, this guy has done it. And he is a random douchebag. It's my friend, Brian Darling. Thanks for coming in, Brian. You're our default guest when we can't get somebody who matters. So I appreciate that. The holiday week and the Congress being sworn in and all of that. You've spent better part of a decade, more than a decade on the Capitol Hill?
Too long, yes.
Too long. So you know how Capitol Hill works. You actually wrote the handbook for Senate rules for senators. You can't buy it at your local Barnes & Noble if you still have one of those. It's not on Amazon, but it is sort of the Bible of Senate rules. And that's part of the reason I wanted to have you in again and talk about it. You're our most frequent guest. And you get to sit near Trumpy Bear.
It's great.
You don't get Trumpy Bear because he's too expensive and we don't give away things here on the show. But the Senate rules, we're now entering Democrat control of the House of Representatives. The House, the last Congress, passed a continuing resolution to fund the government, passed spending bills to fund the government that included $5.6 billion for a border wall. That bill's now dead with the new Congress. But I want to go back in time because it's a point I've made on the show before. You can make it better with more authority. Rule 19 in the Senate, if Republicans really wanted, if Mitch McConnell really wanted to pass that spending bill, if the Republicans had the vote, they could have forced a vote, could they not have?
Yeah, I mean, basically what could have happened is Mitch McConnell, one of the things that is kind of a myth is that you need 60 votes to pass anything in the Senate. What you need 60 votes to do is to shut down debate. But there are ways around that.
There are other ways.
Yeah, and the other way is, say that you get on, say a bill is about to come up before the Senate, and Mitch McConnell says, I am going to move to proceed to this bill, bill number 1234, which funds the government and funds the border wall at $5 billion a year. I move to proceed to that bill. Now, what he usually does is he moves to proceed and immediately does something called like filing cloture, which basically is a petition and debate. He doesn't have to do that. He can just move to proceed to it and force the Democrats to talk and
to
talk.
Actually filibuster.
Yeah, a talking filibuster. And when they stop talking is when you have the vote on the motion to proceed, and you can't filibuster.
But
that.
It's
same
not,
with the bill.
And theoretically, most people know about the filibuster from Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, where Jimmy Stewart speaks for 20 hours or whatever it was until he ultimately collapses. Multiple senators can engage in a filibuster to keep a filibuster going longer, but Rule 19, I believe it's Rule 19, says a senator can only speak twice on any given issue in a legislative day. A legislative day is, it can be a year, it can be whatever the majority deems it to be, especially the majority leader. So theoretically, Democrats could have engaged in a talking filibuster, but eventually the rules would have shut them down even if they weren't done.
It's basically the two-speech rule. You can expedite debate, but the more important idea is once you file cloture on a bill, once you file a motion to end debate, you're actually forcing that 60-vote threshold. And so you get in trouble because you end up having automatically a vote at that you need 60 votes to stop debate. There's also a tactic that hasn't been used in years but used to be used quite a bit, is to file cloture, and then you don't get cloture, and then file cloture. You can keep the Senate on a bill and make them vote every 2 days on cloture until they give up and say, we're not going to filibuster anymore. But I mean, the other method is to just not file cloture, make the Democrats talk, call a quorum call, make them all stand and sit in the well and actually do their jobs, which they don't
do
like
doing.
Do
they have to sit in the well if you do
they're
that?
They're supposed though? To, because if you see that they're not sitting in the well, you say, oh, Mr. Speaker, I see an absence of a quorum, and you get a quorum call and you go hunt down absent senators and you make them sit there. So you basically can get something done without going through the process of having a filibuster, the kind of filibuster that we're used to. You can make the Democrats actually speak until they can't speak anymore. Let them all speak until they run out of breath, but keep them in 24/7 until they have nothing to say, and then you have a vote. And then you don't have to worry about 60 votes.
Now, why hasn't this been employed?
Because senators are lazy. And if you look at the Senate,
I guess senators are lazy. That would just mean to me that you could expedite this process a lot faster. Because nobody wants to be there at 6 a.m. on Christmas morning having to give a speech in order to hold a filibuster. Why hasn't Mitch McConnell done this? To me, it means he doesn't really want – he knows about these rules. He must not want – it that badly.
I think they're lazy. I think one of the problems they have is they get in these methods of operating where they continually do the same things over and over again. They get used to it. Let's take, for example, what's going on now. Now, how many times have we already heard that the House is going to pass a funding bill at the same levels as last year and the Senate's not going to take it up? Well, there are ways around that for Democrats. I mean, there is a procedure Democrats can actually use to get a vote. But say if the Republicans were to actually move to proceed to it and they say, hey, it doesn't matter, we're not going to get 60 votes. Like, constantly you hear one chamber say, oh, we can't do that because they will filibuster. We'll force them to filibuster. And, you know, the Democrats can claim all they want, oh, you know, the president's going to veto. Well, you know, let him veto it. I mean, ultimately these, you know, our Constitution has a process for a reason. And one thing I think, and this is not a partisan issue at all, is one thing that concerns me is, why don't we go through the process that the Constitution set up to have these debates? You know, if the president disagrees, there's nothing wrong with him vetoing something. That's part of his constitutional
right.
duty. Let him do it and then come back and negotiate it again. But all you hear are these closed-door meetings. They were meeting in the Situation Room this week, and they're not getting anything
done. Well,
there's
a whole lot of, we're not even going to try because right. it won't work, which is
yeah.
not exactly the spirit that made this country great.
No. They all want it to go smoothly. House passes, Senate passes, President signs. But that's not the way the Constitution is set up.
So when did this change? Because there used to be required talking filibusters. Now it's just we oppose cloture and everybody just kind of walks away from it.
Well, I mean, the cloture rule, I believe it came into effect, the actual rule, the way it is now, in, I think it was 1971. I think it used to be a higher threshold.
It used to be 67 senators.
Two-thirds. Yeah, it used to be 67 senators before then. And, you know, there was a period of time in the Senate where they didn't have a role at all. And they just kind of spoke and spoke. And that's where you see the Jimmy Stewart version that we so much love, but we don't see much anymore. We have seen it a couple times. We saw Chris Murphy of Connecticut do a filibuster on guns. We've seen
Those filibusters aren't really – the filibusters we've seen reported aren't really – it's really shoddy reporting. What Rand Paul did – and I know you used to work for Rand Paul. I know you're friends with Rand Paul. But what Rand Paul did wasn't an actual filibuster. He just spoke for 23 hours or whatever it was. There was a designated –
13.
Whatever it was. Ted Cruz went
21 hours, okay. Yeah.
But there was a designated cutoff. Cruz wasn't a filibuster either. There was a, I'm going to speak until this point, and then we're going to have a vote.
Well, here's the thing. So the Rand Paul filibuster was one of those weird Senate situations where they were in between business. He grabbed the floor, and they couldn't proceed to the Brennan nomination, which it looks like he was valid in filibustering Brennan to be head of the CIA because that guy turned out to be a dud. But so he did actually have a filibuster, but, you know, there's only so long he could go, and he held up business as much as he could. Now, with Ted Cruz, I always get a kick out of people saying, oh, it wasn't a filibuster. Well, why do you file cloture? It's to shut down debate. And so what Harry Reid did is he filed cloture to shut down debate, and Ted Cruz, you know, filibustered.
But there was an agreement ahead of time at the end point of
That's the rule. The rule stopped him. Like, he could have gone on probably a little bit longer, but the rule actually shut him off. Like, at 1 p.m. the day that cloture ripens is when he had to shut up, excuse me, because of the way the rule's written. So he kind of ran out. He ran against a clock that said that he couldn't speak anymore.
But when you get to that point, then it's not really a filibuster, at least the way I understand it. A filibuster is you can hold the floor as long as humanly possible. There is no expiration date. So there is no time that it doesn't matter come hell or high water at noon tomorrow we're voting. So
right.
you can speak for the next 12 hours if you want. It's or am I reading that wrong?
Well, Rand Paul, excuse me, Rand Paul could have gone on forever. He could have kept going because we were in between business and there was nothing naturally that they could do to stop him. Because basically once a senator has the floor, you can't take the floor away from him until somebody else gets the floor, with the exception of Ted Cruz. Because Ted Cruz had started his filibuster after the leader had gotten the floor and filed cloture, that process had started, so naturally he was going to have to end because there was a scheduled
vote. Cruz could have held the floor forever if he'd done it before cloture.
If he had gotten the floor before cloture, but when you know something like that's going to happen, you're in leadership, you know how to block it.
Why do you think it is that Republican leadership doesn't actually employ the rules to their advantage?
I don't think the leadership's done a very good job. I mean, look at what we've seen over the last 2 years. You know, Trump gets knocked for not accomplishing enough, but he's accomplished a lot despite Congress.
Why don't you take a drink of water, and I'll set up the next question, because the Democrats now control the House of Representatives. Nancy Pelosi is Speaker of the House. They're going to start proceeding on investigation after investigation. They're going to start issuing subpoenas left and right for everything under the sun. Meanwhile, the government is still shut down, and there is no compromise whatsoever in the Democratic Party, at least not right now. Are we looking at complete and total deadlock and indefinite government shutdown, or do we see, as often happens in the past and conservatives are all too used to, Republicans eventually capitulating? Or are we going to get this, here's some border security money. It's not to be used for a wall, but it can be used for a barrier of some sort or metal slats.
And
how do you see the House and Senate working together now that the Senate is more Republican and the House is obviously in Democratic hands?
Well, I am rooting for gridlock. Gridlock would be great, and I'm rooting for a long government shutdown. I don't think that will happen. I think Republicans in the House and Senate will cave at some point and try and cut a deal.
Just because of history? Just because that's what they always do?
Yeah, I mean, I think at some point – I don't think much is actually going to get done. I assume that infrastructure may get done only because it's a lot of money for a lot of districts and it's not really a partisan issue when you're doling out the pork. So something like that might pass. But it's going to be hard to do any real business in the House and Senate because you're going to have the Senate playing defense for the president, not allowing him to get bills that he has to veto. In the House, they're just going to be just manufacturing messaging bills and just sending them over to the Senate. You know, Medicare for all and all of the things they've been campaigning on, free college education and everything that you've seen these Democratic socialists banging, you know, walking around and talking about and arguing about and making the case about, that's what they're going to send over to the Senate, fully well knowing that the Senate isn't going to pass it.
And spending bills have to start in the House, so it's not like the Senate can reverse the flow there and play games with the House and force uncomfortable votes over there.
No, no. Ultimately, the well, and also you're going to have Democrats in the Senate playing defense with the filibuster. They're not going to allow the House to get embarrassed by having bills bounce back and forth. I mean, say, you know, you have a spending bill that gets sent over to the Senate. The Senate can change it and bounce it back to the House. But you won't see that happen because of the filibuster. So you've got a weird situation where Democrats have a pretty strong control over the House. In the Senate, Republicans have control, but they don't have enough control to actually send bills back to the House because of the filibuster.
It's just pathetic. I support a government shutdown, and I think that the president holding firm is a good thing. I don't know how much longer he can do it, quite honestly. The pressure from the media and the Democrats is going to continue to grow, but I also get the sense that he doesn't care anymore. He recognizes that this is a signature issue. There's still a lot, even with divided government, there's still a lot that the government can do, the Senate can do in conjunction with the White House, mostly in nominations.
Oh, sure.
And the executive branch through executive order, unfortunately. It's just a sad reality of where we are these days, thanks to the Obama administration, but also repeal of regulations. Mm-hmm. Now, the Congress, if the president, if the administration, any branch or any department in the administration repeals regulations, Congress can override that. But that seems highly unlikely with a divided Congress.
Yeah, I mean, there's a special procedure to go after regulations and to repeal regulations. You know, it's unlikely you're going to see much happening on that end. But, I mean, you will see – what have we seen to date is we've seen that the Trump administration is loaded up with acting officials, acting interior, acting attorney general. At some point, they're going to have to send nominees to the Senate. There's no filibuster in nomination, so they will be able to get nominations through. We may have more fights on judges, and that may be the big signature issue of the year. But it's going to be fascinating to see – how they come to any agreement in appropriations bills when you have the Trump administration dug in saying there has to be wall funding, we need a certain amount, and the House basically saying we're not going to give you any of the wall funding. Something has to give, and or else the government will not only the departments, the five appropriations bills or seven appropriations bills that haven't passed yet. I mean, you have Homeland Security is the big one, but we may see a full government shutdown come this fall.
There are a lot of people with a lot of opinions, such as life, but there are a lot of people saying that Donald Trump doesn't actually need Congress to build the wall. He can move money around. He can do all sorts of different things. You're sort of bobbing and weaving and nodding your head sort of side to side, which isn't a no, but it isn't a yes.
Yeah, talk a little bit of question.
Talk a little bit about what people are saying, not necessarily whether or not it's true.
Well, I mean, could he reprogram money? Could he use money that's designated for military projects, military construction, for building the wall? You know, ultimately, if he does, then it may be challenged in the courts. But
may be challenged in the
courts.
Well,
it will be.
I guarantee you the briefs are already written. They're just waiting for him to move so they
but
can
plug in. But it's one of those issues that you say, no, you can't do it because it isn't done. Because, you know, there's an appropriations rider that says you can't do it. So if you – say if the administration is contrary to the law and they're using money the way they're not supposed to, what's the remedy? Like what's Congress really going to do about it? You have divided government. They're not really going to stop him because Republicans control the Senate. You cannot – you could not have the Senate without
Republicans
on board to stop it.
That's where the lawsuits from the third-party groups come in, and that's where the judicial activists – then you know that – a lawsuit will be filed in San Francisco in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the judges will say, no, it must stop. We must have an injunction right now. You cannot spend a dime. And that's just going to end it.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, what if they just ignored the injunction?
Well, the last time – I'm sure there are times since then, particularly at the end of segregation.
You have some fascinating separation of powers issues that
we
are
do,
coming up right
but
now.
But the last time this that I know of, the biggest time that I know of, that where a president ignored the courts was Andrew Jackson in the Trail of Tears, where he basically said, let the Supreme Court send their army down there to enforce their order. I'm marching these Indians west. I think given this political environment, if the president of the United States says, damn the torpedoes, full steam ahead, doesn't matter if there's an injunction, we're going to start building a wall, there's your impeachment. There's your constitutional
crisis. I guess,
crisis.
But you can make the case that some district court judge is way overreaching.
You absolutely can make
by
the
saying
case.
That. I understand if the Supreme Court imposes an injunction or even the you know, the circuit, is it the Fourth Circuit or I forget, Fourth or Fifth Circuit that handles that border area. Well, the Ninth Circuit's got part of it, obviously,
right,
in California, but all Texas is a different circuit. If that circuit says you can't do it here, that's one question. But if some district court judge says, oh, you know, you can't do it.
The judge in
it,
Oregon
whatever.
Who likes to weigh in on everything,
yeah,
or the judge in Hawaii who
can
seems
ignore
to
them.
Be able to make policy for the United States. Going forward, though, there – we've gotten rid of Jeff Flake in the Senate. We've gotten rid of
and we got Mitt Romney.
Bob Corker in the Senate. But we've gotten Mitt Romney from a conservative standpoint. There was a lot of talk after the election that, oh, the Senate is much more conservative now than it was then. Is it really, though?
Yeah, it is. It's addition by subtraction because you don't have Bob Corker. You don't have Jeff Flake. Yes, you have Mitt Romney, but you have less of
You still have Lisa Murkowski. You still have Susan Collins.
That's true. I mean, you do have them, but ultimately, you know, you have a Senate. You know, Mitt Romney, you know, I can't tell you how disappointed I am that I voted for that guy
you can
for
tell
president.
Me. You can tell
it's just
me.
Terrible. Like, what was I thinking? But, you know, he comes in.
You were
in,
thinking the alternative was Barack Obama.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, you lived in Washington, D.C. at
the time. I still could have voted Libertarian. But that aside, I mean, he comes into the Senate, you know, writes an op-ed. Maybe he's placing his bet on Trump not running for re-election and him running. But it really, I mean, I still think that overwhelmingly the Senate understands. They saw in the last election that Trump picked up seats in the Senate. And these senators need Trump to have their back, and they have to have his back on a lot of issues, or else this is going to be a complete train wreck for Republicans. You have to have a strategy, and the strategy is coming from the top right now. And, you know, criticizing the president because of his tone is just not helpful.
So you're not going to be writing checks to Mitt Romney's reelection in 2024,
no,
I suppose?
No.
But realistically, though, when on the issues that matter, on the issues that are actually going to get done or at least even come up for a vote in the United States Senate, Mitt Romney is going to be with the Republicans. He's a bit of a scold, and when the president tweets something he doesn't like, he'll definitely come out and tisk, tisk. But he's not going to be like a John McCain, it doesn't seem like,
yeah,
who comes out and gives the famous thumbs down that kept Obamacare in place.
He comes from a different school. He is that big government conservative. You know, he ran
which is
as
a bit of a contradiction.
Well, yeah, but that's his brand.
It's a progressive Republican, I think.
It is. It's somebody who's for intervention everywhere. He is very upset about the president's decision on Syria and Afghanistan. You know, he is somebody who campaigned totally on the other side of those issues, and he's going to be bad on a lot of issues. I mean, he'll vote with the president most on most issues, but ultimately, you know, I think he's going to be pretty irrelevant. Like, what is he going to do that's going to make a name for himself in the Senate?
Well, it's just going to be criticizing the president. And that's,
yeah, well, his
that
tone, but
enough.
He's not really going to be on policy, be able to criticize him on much.
Most people, I don't think, because I sure as hell didn't, and I work when I went to work in the Senate, I thought I have a pretty good grasp on who these senators are, who they I've seen them all. I watch a lot of cable television. Then you get there and you hear the roll call, and you're like, who the hell is that? Who the hell is that? Who the hell is that person?
Right.
Most people, you hear about.
He's still a senator?
Well, you hear about maybe 10 senators maximum,
yeah.
On cable television. There are 100. There are some new faces up there on the Senate in this Congress. Is there anybody you see sort of being somebody that should be paid attention to?
Well, I think Marsha Blackburn from Tennessee is somebody who already is pretty high profile as a
She's
House member.
She's high profile, but I got to be honest, because I'm always honest with the audience. I watched her on with Ed Henry on Shannon Bream's show the other day. I almost texted Ed. I said, just was going to say, you're never going to get a straight answer out of her.
Yeah.
Marsha Blackburn is like far too many Republicans in that they play it safe.
Yeah.
They won't venture where they're uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. They won't say things that they don't think will be unpopular. So while she's definitely high profile because of her stint in the House,
yeah,
I don't see her as being a breakout leader or somebody who's going to come in and certainly she's not going to be a boat rocker. I don't see her really forcing or pushing through legislation.
No, but she'll be a very, very strong defender of the president. I mean, unapologetic. So you will see
a lot of her. I like her. Just don't get
me wrong.
You're
going to see a lot of her.
She's not somebody that if I'm picking generals, she's not going to be my general.
I guess when you see like the Sunday shows, you know, they're going to have her on to promote the president because she's a strong conservative woman, which is lacking in Congress. And then you're going to have Mitt Romney probably be the poster child for somebody who's a little bit against the president who can come in and give like a different opinion.
But is there anybody else out there that you see coming in the freshman class on the Republican side? Who, Braun, anybody else out there you see?
Well, I mean, you have the former governor of Florida, Tim Scott, or Scott coming in, and I don't know where he's going to end up. Like, I'm interested to see if these new members emerge as leaders. You know, Kyrsten Sinema ran as a moderate in Arizona. We know she's really not a moderate, so I'm wondering if she's going to come out.
But we also have Martha McSally, who lost to Sinema.
Right.
Did she get sworn in yet? Is she the senior senator from Arizona by about 20 minutes?
She should have been if she was sworn in, but you know, before. But I assume I don't know. That's a good question because that is kind of important. You know, who's a senior, who's a junior. But, you know, you're going to have McSally is in a tough spot where she's running for re-election in 2 years. Then if she wins again, she has to run again. She's going to run in three cycles. It's almost like being back in the House.
Well, maybe the third time's a charm and she'll actually win. Compare what you – like, I look at the class that Rand Paul came in on. Mm-hmm. It had Mike Lee. It had Marco Rubio.
Yeah.
Three people. Normally, senators come in – and they sit back. It was a big deal when they give their first floor speech. They wait 6 months before they actually give a floor speech, which strikes me as odd. Mm-hmm. But that was just kind of the tradition. But those guys came in, and they didn't sit back. They didn't.
Right.
Rand Paul came in with sharp elbows and a legislative agenda. Mm-hmm. It didn't go anywhere. But he came in pushing it. He came in giving speeches. He came in introducing legislation. He came in blocking legislation. Mike Lee as well, much less confrontational, but I would argue a little bit more effective.
But it took him a while. But both of them have made a lot of progress. I mean, you look at the Rand Paul foreign policy, the restrained foreign policy. I think it's more accepted.
Right. But I'm not talking about what they eventually became. I'm talking about what they were when they first got there. That wasn't the norm.
Yeah, it's true.
And do you see anybody in this class sort of taking that model, or do you see it going reverting back to the traditional model?
You look at, with the exception of Mike Lee, you know, Rubio and Rand Paul ran for president.
Right.
And then in the next cycle, you had Ted Cruz come in who kind of went in the same model, came in guns blazing and then ran for president. Mm. Do we see any of these new members maybe looking at the White House at some point in the future? I don't know. I don't look at any of them and see, you know, presidential material in them right now. But we'll
do you see any of them coming in with, here's a bill. Here, I want to push for this bill. This is what I want. Because they didn't sit back and wait their turn. And
right.
I liked that. They were not elected to go there and learn the ropes and get along. They were elected very specific mandates to go and change things.
Yeah, I mean, look at Mike Lee basically blew up a primary situation where he had no chance in the early stages of winning that. You know, he went into they have a convention in Utah and he stirred that up and the incumbent got knocked out and he took the seat and he was a persona non grata in the Senate for a while.
They were going to change the way that the Republican Party selected their nominees because Mike Lee was so successful.
Right.
He was against the power structure there and they did not like it.
Same with Rand Paul, ran against the anointed, you know, future senator. Same with Ted Cruz. He ran against a former lieutenant governor, I believe, who was actually supposed to be appointed to the seat when Kay Bailey Hutchison was thinking about running for governor. And then when the actual election happened, he lost. So did we have any situations in the last cycle where somebody who wasn't expected to win a primary won? I don't really think so. I think Blackburn was expected to win her primary. You didn't really have that. Florida, the governor was expected to win the primary. You don't have really outsiders that just came in guns blazing into the Senate in the cycle.
From a conservative standpoint, is is there something to look forward to this Congress?
Gridlock. Or
aside from gridlock. Because, you know, there's the only thing they can get together on is when they piss away a bunch of our money. And infrastructure is a nice buzzword for pissing away a bunch of money and paying off their friends back in their states with various road projects right. and contracts that go with it. Even most Republicans will go along with that. They like the idea of I'm bringing home the bacon because they can point to a road project and say, we're repaving Interstate 95 or whatever like that. But that's not really something to look forward to. That's going to be straight up deficit spending.
Think about the last Congress. There were maybe four really exciting things that happened, five if you count the government shutdown. You had two Supreme Court justices. You had the implosion of the repeal of Obamacare, and you had the tax bill. And that was pretty much it. I mean, you really didn't have any real exciting things happening in Congress. A lot of the excitement came in the executive branch side with all the repeals of regulations and getting out of the Paris Climate Change Agreement, pulling out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, all the talk about, you know, trashing the North American Free Trade Agreement, and then we get a new free trade agreement, pulling troops out of different countries. I feel like the real news happened not at all in Congress, and I think what we will see is the big news hooks this year are going to be government shutdowns and gridlock and when things don't happen.
I don't like this, but this will be the last thing. Not that I don't like that this will be the last thing. I'm glad this is the last thing. Get rid of you. But Barack Obama made a model for the presidency that with his magic pen and his magic phone circumvented Congress. And large pieces of that, even through courts, DACA, the courts have said, no, you can't get rid of this until, you know, unless it's now before the Supreme Court, which is still taking a very long time. And the courts have been sort of writing immigration policy after the president wrote immigration policy, none of which is prescribed in the Constitution. I don't like my tyrant ruling through executive order because right. I didn't like their tyrant ruling by executive order. But is there a case to be made for President Trump, if this is the way that the presidency is going to be run, to maybe use that magic pen, dust it off a little bit?
Why not? And challenge
Congress. Why not? Is a constitutional principle. Not that he's a constitutional conservative, but from my perspective.
Well, the thing is, what is the remedy? Here's what you have to look at. If the executive branch overreaches, what is the remedy? Well, Congress is supposed to step up and stop overreach. And the courts are supposed to step up and stop
dispose
overreach,
of
too.
Trumpy Bear.
But if the, you know, at some point, if the president wants to just say, you know, I'm going to challenge Congress, let's see what they do, and he will purposely overreach to see if they push back, you know, the only real remedy Congress has is to either defund or to impeach. And we have to assume at some point the Democrats are going to go down that road anyways.
Right. Okay, final last question, though. Do conservatives in particular have to get better at the lawsuit game the way Democrats are? Because every move this administration makes, it swarms like flies to feces, filing lawsuits.
They
always
they
seem
lawsuits.
To know where to file the lawsuits yeah. to get the injunctions from the local district court judges that affect the entire nation.
Yes.
Do we have to – is that really the future of politics, and are we going to have to step up our game with that?
Yes, but also, I mean, look at the big – one of the big cases this past year was a case in Texas where you had a former Senate staffer who's now a judge – stop Obamacare and basically start the process of
but there was no injunction with that. He
yeah.
allowed it to stand. When Democrats win, it's stop right now and forever. It can never
yeah.
be. When a conservative or Republican wins, they're like, okay, well, I see this is unconstitutional, but I'll allow it to go on. If you believe it's unconstitutional,
right.
I don't know how you can allow it to go on. Why is that?
I think because he knows that this case is going to go right up to the Supreme Court, and he didn't want it to go up. I guess it would go up faster, and it would be more likely to get overturned. If you do an injunction and stop Obamacare, very likely you get overturned or at least have the injunction suspended, which hurts your case. So I think it's a tactical move. I understand it. Had this been early in Obamacare, it would have been easier to do, but Obamacare has been around so long. It's hard to just buy, you know, for some district court judge to say, you know what, it's gone. I'm getting rid of it.
It's sad that we're now a country ruled by the whims of judges and five of nine
exactly.
people on the Supreme Court. We shouldn't even notice what's going on in the federal government on a daily basis, and now it affects so much of our life. Brian Darling, at Brian H. Darling on the Twitter machines.
Yes, thank you.
Follow him there. I follow him. And our children just had a successful play date the other day.
It was so great. They didn't beat each other up.
Took a little while for my daughter to get comfortable. Yeah,
too much crying.
And then there was some crying at the beginning because you almost fell on her.
I did. I almost fell on his daughter.
He's got a bouncy house in his back room, and he's leaning in, and he lost his balance this whole
thing. I almost squashed her.
And that was the only reason my daughter cried. That coming at you, that's going to make you cry.
Yes.
I would cry if he leaned over here right now. Anyway, I'm Derek Hunter. This is the Daily Daily Caller Podcast. Please tell a friend. Please subscribe. Spread the word. And be back here on Monday for another exciting episode. Have a great weekend.